As we all know, we are living in an age of great scientific research, and we find tremendous development taking place in many fields of human learning. As far as man himself is concerned, science has built up an enormous amount of knowledge concerning man's bodily nature, his heredity, his environment, the fundamental physics and chemistry of his composition, the complex functions of his glands, blood, and brain. And we find today that this research is being pushed to enormous lengths as the possibility of flight into space is contemplated. In fact, a new science has now been called the science of space medicine. Can man endure higher and higher speeds of locomotion and acceleration? Can he plunge into weightlessness? What are the duration of stresses tolerable to a human being? Medical science is increasing in leaps and bounds with the knowledge concerning man, and as volunteers endure all sorts of trials and ordeals in order to learn more and more about the potentialities of man in facing new experiences in the race to conquer space. And yet, despite this fascinating research, when a complete picture of man, which emerges, is revealed by anatomy, physiology, biochemistry, psychology, space medicine, and other scientific fields, there is still something of the utmost significance missing. And we are forced to admit that in spite of the brilliant intellects which have considered the nature of man, there is still one question about man's fundamental nature which remains unsolved. The question of man's selfhood. Who and what am I? None of these sciences can answer this question. Now, we all do no doubt believe that we exist, that we are. And this we describe as self-consciousness, even though the self cannot be tested in the science laboratory. And each one of us says, I. And this I is the motivating principle of our being. We show evidence of our belief in our existence when we say, I am, I believe, I think, and I will. Unfortunately, however, even though we have arrived at this stage of self-consciousness, most of us do not penetrate very much deeply. And we do not try to discover for ourselves what we really are. Then, of course, we continue to identify ourselves with the personality and to believe that that expresses the true man. Now, as our chairman said, the society has three objects, and the third one is to investigate the unexplained laws of nature and the powers latent in man. In other words, we are trying to discover for ourselves what we are and what powers we possess. According to the system of philosophy, which we call theosophy, this I, this self, for want of a better analogy, is often described as a spark of the divine flame. That is, that it is part of the one divine principle or life, call it God or that or what you will, which is inherent and permeating the whole of manifestation. This spark is individualized within the soul of each one of us, is buried in the matter of our personalities, and it is claimed by the ancient teachings of old, that it is possible for man to begin a process of self-discovery, to disentangle himself from his identification with the personality in which this divine spark is buried, and to discover by his own direct experience the truth of his own immortality. It is suggested that we can begin this process in a very simple way, by experimenting with ourselves, as it were trying to stand apart from the personality and look at it objectively, to test the truth of the statement that I am not my physical body or my emotions or my mind, by a process of self-exploration. You can begin in a simple way. Gaze at your hand, for instance. Look at it as mere disassociated form. I am not my hand, for even if my hand be cut off, the body may be limited, but I remain. Look into your eyes in the mirror. Gaze at them and ask yourself, are you those eyes? Subject and object are something apart. They cannot be the same. You are the perceiver, that which perceives, and therefore the object, the form, is that which is perceived, is something different. If you are not your body, then are you anger, fear, trust, doubt, kindness, pride, or any of the other various modes of action of the emotions and the mind? Ask yourself. You will discover that you experience these actions of the emotions in the mind, but that you can stand aside and look at them and see yourself going through those processes. Therefore, you are the perceiver. You are not those things. Are you reason or perception or discrimination? No, you cannot say that those are you. You express them. You act through them.
But there is something which is you, which is something more. What are you then?
When you have struck away these temporary coverings, these external elements that compose the mind and the personality, which are very necessary, of course, for you to experience and to contact the phenomenal world. At the same time, can you break away from them? Can you take away this outer crust and discover what it is within you that animates you, that gives you this principle, I am? I think we all probably agree that this waking consciousness, which we experience, is not a full expression of ourselves, that there is something more. Psychology tells us of different layers of awareness, and psychology describes these as subconscious, superconsciousness, subliminal consciousness, and so on. And occasionally we ourselves discover suddenly that there are depths within ourselves that we rarely touch, but which may suddenly come into action through an experience, what we might call an ascetic experience. When we are perhaps uplifted, when listening to a beautiful symphony, or gazing at a beautiful landscape, standing down by the seashore. There are moments in our lives of ecstasy, exquisite moments of illumination, which suddenly take us out of our ordinary personality, our ordinary state of consciousness. And for a moment, we can, without any effort, spontaneously, as it were, be united with that to which we become, for a moment, by which we become illumined. We are one with it, identified with it. There is no consciousness of being separate from it. We can have it also in great moments of devotion, when in a moment of outpouring, of adoration, we can become united with that to which we pour our devotion. Now this is described as a mystical experience, and it brings with it an increasing sense of relationship. On the physical level, we all feel at times, I'm sure, the intense solitariness, the loneliness of our individuality. There you are and here am I. You are outside of myself. You are other than myself. You do not know me, really, and I do not know you. All I have are the impressions which I gain through my senses, my contact with you. And so there is, as it were, a division between us. But if there is, at the same time, a certain affinity between us, then we can find that our minds can come into communication with each other, that we can deepen our relationship. We can learn to know each other better. We go beyond the ordinary impressions of the physical senses. And so we have a communication when mind meets mind. Now, if we can go even deeper and have the profound mystical experience, even for a moment, of which I spoke, then it brings with it the possibility of a deepening sense of relationship. And of course, the relationship which exists between those who experience true love is something more than the physical relationship. There is a merging of consciousness in some very mysterious and profound way. In the profoundest mystical experience, the overwhelming discovery is made, according to the testimony and mystics throughout the ages, that the self, the I, that which I think of as me, is not separate from others in its essence, that we are all part of the one life, and that we are embraced within this one life, and that in our ultimate essence, we all share and are part of that one. It is as if all the lights in this room, although appearing to be separate, each one showing out its own individuality, when traced back to its source, each one of it, though an individual light in its expression, comes from the one powerhouse, is sharing the one power. In the same way with us, so it is suggested, we are all, as it were, rays from the one central sun, and if we can explore into the depths of our own being, we can trace back within ourselves into this ocean. I'm using so many different analogies, the light, the powerhouse, the ocean, the one life, whatever you like, and find your identity with all others. This sublime truth has found expression in the deeper insights of all the great religions. And thus, from Christianity, we have the saying, Christ is all in all. I am the vine, ye are the branches, till Christ be formed in you. In Hinduism, there is the great affirmation, that art thou. In Buddhism, we find the metaphorical terms, the dewdrop slips into the shining sea, implying that the individual self of each one of us can be merged into the great sea of all. In all these different teachings, then, we have given to us the key to the understanding of our life in form, which it is suggested is to realize that this individual self, this I, is an aspect of the one universal self. Or, as the ancient teaching says, the macrocosm is reflected in ourselves as microcosms. If this be so, and it certainly seems worthy of consideration, we see that the struggle for reality is to escape from the bondage of the personality and the senses, and to soar within ourselves into a higher level of consciousness. I don't mean to escape from our obligations, to escape from our life, but as it were, to base our understanding of life, to find a meaning with regard to our existence, which springs from a deeper level, a deeper source within ourselves, and is not based on our ordinary sensory existence, as many of us do at present. Now, there is given a way of achieving this state through a scientific method of self-exploration, by a deliberate effort at setting aside the personality, stilling the mind, preparing it and holding it in tranquil expectation so that it may reflect the truth of our immortality and we may contact and experience directly the truth of our own immortality. Christianity is not very rich in psychological techniques for such interior exploration, though it points the way to such a vision. We have the testimony of the mystics through the ages. We have the different degrees of arisen, which are used in the mystic teachings. There are various methods and prayers of contemplation, which of course must be pruned of any petitionary element and transformed into pure meditation. But it is to the East that we must turn for the most complete techniques to help us in our search. Behind the popular forms of the Eastern religions, Hinduism, Buddhism, and others, there is a psychological technique known as yoga, which is practiced by those who seek self-union, that is, union with the divine, the whole. Although we turn to the East for these techniques, it doesn't mean that we have to leave our own religious system, but that it can be practiced. This is a psychological, scientific curriculum and technique which has nothing to do with the religious teaching or as such, and it can be practiced without in any way changing one's own religious affiliation. It is merely the technique that we are considering. Now, the meaning of yoga, the word itself, means union. And it is applied to the concept of the union with the divine life in all manifestation. A second use of the word yoga is, of course, the scientifically arranged curriculum of self-training, study, and practice which will lead the seeker toward that goal. And this constitutes a method whereby the consciousness is merged with this higher spirit, this self within each one of us. In other words, it is a technique which is designed to lead us to the conscious union between the human self and the divine. In recent years, there's been a great effort to popularize yoga in Western lands, and it has become quite a fashionable practice for many people. Unfortunately, we do find at times that these practices of yoga are being exploited for worldly benefit. How to win friends and influence people, how to sell more, how to gain what you want. It is true that it is possible to develop a form of mind control by following these practices. And that, of course, means for the use of self-aggrandizement to gratify desire, for obtaining success. But that has nothing to do with the true meaning of yoga, for the true meaning is to lead, of course, to freedom from desire. There's also another conception that in order to practice yoga, it's necessary to twist one's body into all sorts of difficult postures. Now, I'm not in any way condemning the use of certain types of exercises which are derived from the yoga systems, which can be very helpful in toning up the body and the nerves and helping one to overcome various ailments and so on. But let us not forget, if there is not the right attitude towards these, if there is not also at the same time a training of the mind, a spiritual relationship behind them, then they'll have no meaning as far as true yoga is concerned. They will have value as far as gymnastics are concerned. But they will have no value unless there is this building of the body is a temple for the divine self. Union, that is the meaning of yoga. There is also, of course, a warning given to those who practice certain types of yoga using the breath and body control that without proper direction, they may awaken certain psychic forces, and this can be very dangerous. Now, whilst we talk about this system, let us not for a minute think that yoga need necessarily be otherworldly. On the contrary, yoga leads not to an escape from the world, but rather to its reinterpretation through greater understanding. It implies a keen search for truth and wisdom. And as I said earlier, it is an attempt to discover what we are and why we are, and thus to give us a new poise, a new direction in our lives, without escaping from our obligations and undertakings. And so this science that we're talking about is not limited to those who can withdraw into a cave to meditate, for there is the path of action in daily life. The way of self-knowledge, self-conquest, is open to every one of us at any moment of time, provided the attitude is turned in the right direction. At the same time, we in the West, with the constant pressure of daily life, the hustle and bustle, trying to earn our living, unconditioned as we are, most of us, to contemplative practices, and our bodies unprepared for the psychic strain and other dangers which the ignorant practice of yoga can induce. What we need, then, is a study, an approach to this study and a practice which begins in a very simple way. And that is why I have entitled this talk this evening, Yoga for the Western Mind, because I am not going into the deeper, difficult techniques, but to find a simple way which can help us in our daily life. What we are seeking is a method of spiritual quiet which will help us to withdraw into the stillness of the heart and to probe into the deep recesses of our own being. In the East, there are various techniques according to the particular school or philosophic system which one may follow, the temperament of the seeker, and so on. For instance, there is the bhakti yoga, the way of devotion. There is the yoga of japa or mantram, the chanting of certain sacred formulae in order to align the consciousness, to still the mind, and to raise one's state of awareness. There is the hatha yoga, that is the yoga by which the breath is controlled, the bodily built, in order that the self may be, the physical personality may become a temple for the self to express itself. But again, as I mentioned, one which it is difficult for us to follow. There is that which is called the laya yoga, the forcing of certain powers of the body through the vortices or centers which are said to be near to the ductless glands. There is the jnana yoga, the way of wisdom and understanding. And also, and finally, the raja yoga, the kingly science, the way of raising consciousness through the direct use of the will. Now, obviously, I haven't time to discuss all these different methods, but I want to particularly mention the last one, Raja Yoga, which really, in its essence, embraces the main concepts of all the other forms, and in a simplified form, as I said, nevertheless, the genuine Eastern teaching, based on the system developed by the great Eastern sage Patanjali, which it is suggested is the most suitable for the Western mind. Now, the different systems, which these different systems, disciplines, and systems all lead to, the same aim, which is that, as I've said, of union with the Supreme. And the purpose of these different systems is to destroy the illusions which arise through identification with our physical, emotional, and mental functions. And so we might sum it up and say that the control and direction of the mind is the crux of the whole path of yoga. All these other things are preparation for this. The mind, as we know, is continually being impressed with the pictures of 1,000 objects clamoring for attention through ears, eyes, skin, the other senses, by telepathic impressions. And in addition to all this, the mind is in a continual state of agitation, bubbling with disturbed visions and uncontrolled emotion, continually searching for satisfaction and security, which it is unable to find. Hinder this game. Hinder the modifications of the thinking principle within you, said Patanjali. Stop all this. And when you do, you will know yourself as the seer. the seer of the essence of things. And so we come to the simple but ancient and very profound injunction, which we have also in our own scripture: be still and know. That's all it is. Be still and know. This is the method of inward realization, to still the mind and know. It sounds simple, and yet it is so very difficult. Instead of a whirlpool, let the mind become as a clear, unruffled mirror, which may then be clear, without images, able to receive intimations from the divinity within. And it is because it is so difficult to achieve the state of stillness of the mind that all these various techniques have been laid down. Now let us see what this training is. The method in Raja Yoga, the ancient Raja Yoga, is divided into two parts. There is first the preliminary training in order to weaken the five afflictions of ignorance, egoism, desire, aversion, and clinging to bodily life. And in order to do this, there are set forth various practices. The first is to treat the physical body as you know to be good for it. In other words, to lead a healthy life. The second practice relates to the study of ideas that really concern oneself as an immortal being. That is, to study the whole teaching relating to man. And the third practice is to practice devotion and reverence toward the divine consciousness pervading all things. That is, the divine life, God. Now these requirements, if you really think about it, are ones which fall into any ethical or spiritual teaching. In other words, to orient oneself towards this goal, to prepare oneself by one's outlook, one's way of life, to move towards this goal, because unless one's trying to live a reasonably good, what we might call religious life in the ordinary sense, I don't mean in seclusion, but orienting our mind towards these things, obviously we cannot achieve very much. And so having then oriented one's self towards this goal of yoga, then the next steps which are prescribed are moral steps. Again, these fit into our own religious teaching. Thou shalt not injure, lie, steal, be greedy. Thou shalt be clean, content, self-control, studious, and devoted. In other words, these are ordinary concepts which we can accept and realize as compatible and reasonable for anybody who is interested in any way in what we might call the spiritual life, which of course is what yoga implies. They are fundamental ethical and moral rules which are laid down in any religious teaching, and that is why you can see that they fit in with our own Christian precepts. It is a matter of orientation and preparation. And anybody, for instance, who comes here this evening, who's interested in this type of thought, is, as it were, moving in this direction. Now we come to the actual practice of yoga. That is, the form of introspection and self-discovery. This means having a time each day to go into the processes of one's own self, to enter into a state of meditation. And therefore we are required, if we wish to practice yoga, to have these few moments of quiet. Otherwise, obviously, we cannot learn to still the mind. Again, this must be fitted in when we have to have our hustle and bustle. But if we're really interested, we can find a few moments when we can endeavor to practice this system. Now the requirements which are laid down are right posture, right breathing, and right control of the senses. That means the proper control of the outer instrument. And so one finds a place of complete privacy and freedom from intrusion, and seated in a posture in which the spine is kept straight. Now, for us in the West, the most comfortable position is seated on a chair upright. In the East, you will find they usually are seated cross-legged in what is called the lotus position. But this is not absolutely essential. We need to be seated in a comfortable posture. And as we gradually go forward in this practice, there is the gradual slowing down of the breathing, which comes automatic as the practice proceeds. Now we come to the very essence of our subject. And there follows three steps towards which everything else has been leading up. These are concentration, meditation, and contemplation. Concentration is the narrowing of the field of attention, that is, fixing the mental eye upon a chosen object. To begin with, it may be some concrete thing to help us focus the mind on that object. Later on, it may become some abstract idea, the idea of beauty or truth, or some quality. And then, as we proceed, we take the idea of the spiritual self, that is, the idea of contacting the self within. But we start off with taking some physical object which will help us to control and to concentrate the mind. So we have concentration, and then the next step, which is meditation. Meditation means the flow of thought with regard to an object which one is holding in one's mind, or an idea, or a quality, or some great concept. It is the realization of that object or idea as fully as possible, considering every detail and part. Then, when in meditation we have reached the highest and fullest thought that one can about this chosen object, then the next step is contemplation. And this is the moment when thinking ceases. The machinery of the mind becomes quiescent, and that which is the subject of meditation is seen bereft of form, one's consciousness is merged into the life of that thing, and there is identity. Then the object is moved from the mind altogether, dropped from the mind. The mind is held in that poised state, and then the mind has become a mirror which is able to reflect the illumination which comes from within. Now you may say that sounds very difficult and impossible of realization. And I suppose for some of you it's difficult to follow what I've been talking about. But let's see, by a very simple illustration, if you can follow the movement of consciousness which takes place. This, of course, is quite an old illustration which is often given, and I have found it very helpful, and so I pass it on to you. Let us take, then, as an example for this practice, a beautiful flower, let us say a beautiful rose. If you first of all look at that rose and concentrate fully on it and imagine its shape and its texture and its color and so on, then, of course, putting the rose aside and yet holding in your mind the image which you have built of that rose, you can come to a state of concentration with regard to it. Holding that rose in your mind, you think of its texture, its color, its fragrance, its relationship to the rose kingdom. You can analyze and dissect it mentally. Think of its relation to the vegetable kingdom, of how it has been warmed by the sun, nourished by the earth, watered by the rain. All these factors of nature have brought this beautiful rose which you hold in your mind. And so you are in a state of analyzing. You are concentrating, analyzing the rose. But now suddenly, quite unconsciously, your mind raises itself to a higher level. Instead of analyzing that rose, you are beginning to, as it were, pour your life towards it. You are bringing into your consciousness the idea of wonder with regard to the rose. How were roses fashioned? What is the life that flows in that rose? What is the archetypal rose? And so on. Gradually, your thought is taking on a new quality. You have unconsciously moved into the realm of meditation, of analyzing thought, of abstract mind. and you are no longer concentrating on the rose as an external object. You are beginning to know the rose in a new sense. You are coming to realize the beauty and wonder of that flower that you could not imagine before could occur from such an exercise. You begin to realize that rose as fulfilling its function in life and as an expression of the divine consciousness, all the time refusing the extraneous thoughts which try to impinge upon your mind. Now there comes a moment when you cease consciously to think of the rose, but as it were, pour the whole of your being towards it. And then you become aware of a strange and deepening quietness. A strange thing happens. There is the possibility almost of merging with that flower. In some way you will find it responds to you. The life in that object and in yourself is merged. There is an act of true communion, and it is possible to be identified with it. The life in the rose and the life in you are one. Now this means that one is able to achieve a state of unity whereby the consciousness, through this practice, has identified itself with the life behind the form, in other words, has freed itself from the limitation of form. And that is an act of true meditation. And then comes the next step, which takes us into the realm of contemplation. Having reached through these steps of meditation, concentration and meditation, a poised state of spiritual attention, one should drop the rose altogether from one's mind, no longer thinking of the rose as an object, but holding that fixed attention which one has achieved through the rose, and then one reaches a state of pure contemplation. There is no image in the mind. The mind has become bereft of all form. It is completely emptied. It is not focused on anything. It is in a state of complete quiescence. That is the stillness of the mind, where it has become a true mirror, able to receive an illumination from within, which normally cannot enter because of all the clutter, all the forms and images which are filling the mind. It has been emptied of all image, and it is possible at that moment to have a true illumination, a true spiritual experience. Now, as the meditation proceeds, of course this won't come in one moment. It takes a great deal of effort and continuous effort. Then it is suggested that the object be not some material thing, such as the rose, but, as I said, something abstract. For instance, beauty. You remember those beautiful words of Plato, who was able to raise consciousness from the beauty of form to the abstract idea of absolute beauty, a form of yoga by progressive steps. Or for those who are devotional, it may be possible to try to identify your consciousness with some divine figure, let us say the Christ, and try to merge into his consciousness and to identify yourself with that great being. All these are forms by which one may be taken out of one's personality into a wider, more transcendental state of awareness. Now, of course, you can say this is very difficult, and of course it is. And yet it is possible, through continued effort, to find the reality and value of such an experience, until one can come to the state whereby it is possible to penetrate all images, however lovely and significant, to get beyond the form into the life. And so there comes that experience which the mystics have described as naked contemplation, when the seeker knows his identity with the universe. Of course, I'm taking you into the highest concepts of this teaching. Naturally, it cannot all be done at once. But there is possible an understanding which comes in flashes. You will find that there is, as it were, an opening in your consciousness gradually built. You may not notice it at the moment when you are practicing meditation, but perhaps during the day, at some other time, some flash of understanding, some concept, some experience will happen, which has come because you yourself, as it were, have opened the channel to allow something more to enter your consciousness. I, of course, in this talk, have talked about the loftiest goals, the highest concepts which the yoga, practice of yoga, can bring us. And we may not have immediate results. But if we persevere, then the teachers of yoga tell us there will come gradually a purifying of character, a deepening of understanding. We will be in greater touch with the life within, the true self. And so gradually, as the practice continues, a new facility will spring up. This true self is revealed, begins to take over more and more command of the personality. The mind becomes an instrument for the thinker within. And as I said, this can be of practical value in our daily lives. We can, of course, if we are not able to go as deeply as I've suggested, find simpler forms of meditation whereby we can watch ourselves even as we walk along the street. Start watching our actions, reactions, our moods, our emotions, our thoughts. Stand aside and watch them. And as we do, we will begin to disassociate ourselves from them and to realize ourselves as something more. Meditation isn't only at those moments of quiet that I suggested, but at other times during the day, it is possible in a small way to begin this practice. Now, finally, I would like to mention one of the valuable guides to meditation, which you will find in our theosophical literature. And this has been formulated and written down by Mr. Geoffrey Hodgson. Many of you will already know it. And it appears in the little book, A Yoga of Light. This is a form of Raja Yoga, and it is of value to each one of us because it is safe and it is in line with the true yogic system. This begins with the practice of disassociation, which I mentioned earlier. That is trying to center one's awareness in the higher self. It comes through an affirmation. And through that affirmation, which at first is simply an affirmation or a belief, but gradually can become a realization, one begins to realize oneself as something more than the physical body and the personality. And so the affirmation is suggested, I am not the physical body, I am the spiritual self. I am not the emotions, I am the spiritual self. I am not the mind, I am the spiritual self. In such a way, first of all through creative imagination, and then through an actual experience, it is possible to withdraw one's consciousness from the physical brain into what we call the ego, the self. And then there attempts a further ascent in consciousness towards the spiritual self by affirming, I am the divine self, immortal, eternal, radiant with spiritual life. And it is suggested here that it is possible to think of oneself as a center of white light, pure light in the universe. And identifying oneself with the consciousness of that light to affirm, I am that self of light, that self am I. If one continues this practice, one is able to transfer consciousness from the physical, purely sensory level of awareness into abstract, intuitional, purely spiritual states of awareness. And so the movement continues, and there comes the affirmation, that self in me is one with the self in all, the unifying of consciousness with the one life of all, I am that, that am I. And it is possible in this way to lift one's consciousness into that state of awareness that I mentioned before, to still the mind, and therefore to experience a true spiritual awareness. And then as the meditation ceases, we are warned to return to the ordinary consciousness by the same route as we followed on the upward journey. And this, of course, applies to other practices which one may follow. Now, by trying such a practice, one is able to bring into one's personality for the day ahead a quality of peace, of inward poise, of harmony. You'll find it will help you to meet the problems of the day with greater understanding, with greater poise, and with less identification with the things around you, even as you carry on your daily duties and your daily avocation. Now, what has been suggested are but one or two simple forms, and there are many others. Each one, of course, must find out what is right for him according to his temperament. But if one does decide to follow a particular form and one is satisfied as to its integrity and its value, then, of course, one should follow the directions which are given in order that the results which follow are not in any way dangerous to the psychic nature. Of course, we cannot expect immediate results. And yet, through perseverance, there can come an inner peace and serenity in the midst of the turmoil of worldly activity. Some people think that forms are not necessary, that they are restrictive and binding. And there, of course, is no dogma about this. The forms, we must remember, are not meant to be forms to bind us, but rather to release consciousness, to provide a springboard by stilling the mind, by which there can be that sublime experience described by Plotinus, the flight of the soul from the alone with a small a to the alone with a big A, the alone to the alone, the great experience which is beyond form and word and reason. And that is why all these experiences which the mystics and the yogas have tried to talk about, these illuminations which are possible, are beyond word and description and form, because they are in the formless world. And the words which we use, of course, are only symbols. The intellectual horizon fades into a world of another dimension, and the mind in a poised state is illumined. And so it is possible for the thinker, the seeker, to enter a new mind mode of apprehension, to reach a transcendental state of awareness, whereby the mind, instead of being colored just from without through the senses, is lit from within, striving to express the inexpressible. And even if we have that experience for 1 second, then it will, by its reality, it will illumine our lives, our actions, our understanding, and even though its vision may fade, it will never be lost. Walt Whitman described meditation as devout ecstasy, the soaring flight. He said, "Bibles may convey and priests expound, but it is exclusively for the noiseless operation of one's isolated self to enter the pure ether of veneration, reach the divine levels, and commune with the unutterable." That is the true purpose of yoga, that the mind may be lit from within and thus become a sanctuary which is touched by the white light of infinity. Thank you.